Sounds good. Hello, my name is Kate, and I'm a graduate student at the Massachusetts College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences in Boston. The CDC reports that 130 Americans die each day from an opioid-related overdose, and nearly 2 million Americans have been diagnosed with opioid use disorder. I am working on a project alongside other students to bring attention to the work being done by individuals and organizations who are on the front line of the opioid epidemic. Our goal in this project is to shed light on pivotal attempts to provide to improve the health of our communities and the lives of those impacted by this opioid use. Today, I would like to welcome Mr. Frederick Ryan, former police chief in Arlington, Mass., and co-chair of PARI, the Police Assisted Addiction and Recovery Initiative. Mr. Ryan now works for Alkermes, the maker of Vivitrol, a monthly injection for the treatment of alcohol and opioid dependence. Hello, Mr. Ryan. Thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me.
Would you mind telling us a bit more about your background?
Happy to. So, yes, I spent 33 years in law enforcement, beginning in the early 1980s. Until recently when I retired after serving 20 years as chief of police in Arlington, Massachusetts, which is a suburb of Boston, densely populated suburb of Boston. And I had a front row seat during my career to addiction and the opioid epidemic that you described, and experienced firsthand the flawed policies and the flawed treatment systems and the lack of parity between behavioral health and addiction medicine and traditional medical surgical medicine, and found myself in the unique position as a law enforcement executive, really almost solely focused toward the end of my career on behavioral health and addiction policy issues to drive meaningful change to get people access to evidence-based care for their illnesses, and rather than incarcerating people who are suffering with opioid use disorder or behavioral health illnesses, directing them toward a healthcare system that had the capacity and desire to treat such patients.
Mm-hmm. How have you seen that the situation has changed since the 80s when you began your work?
Well, you know, as a young cop, I was trained to, and young cops are like puppy dogs. You can train them to do whatever you want them to do, and I was trained to go out and arrest people for drug offenses, and I did that. And over time, as I got to know some of the people that I'd been arresting, and got to learn about their challenges and lack of treatment options and barriers to quality treatment for their illness, I realized that, you know, the circular door at the police station and the courthouse was simply a bad policy, and it needed to change. And so as I went up through the ranks and became a chief of police in the Metro Boston area, I seized that opportunity to lead some change and work with our partners in public health to achieve the change.
Mm-hmm. When you were working as police chief and when you were working with PARI, what was the status of Arlington at the time as it relates to the opioid epidemic?
Yeah, so there was, you know, one point where we were losing to a fatal overdose about one resident per month. And in a closely knit suburban community, you know, it was devastating. And I was attending the funerals of the children of people that I'd gone to high school with and played ball with. And it was simply devastating our community. And you know, many, many more non-fatal overdoses monthly. So that's when we rolled up our sleeves and decided that that we as a community, not only the police department, but our public health agency, and our fire department and community-based addiction advocates, we all teamed together and had a massive change to the way that we were going to police and manage the opioid crisis in our jurisdiction. You see, you know, we had hundreds of names of people who we knew were in our community that were in the grips of addiction to opioids. And, you know, because they're in a database. They, you know, we had previously responded to and reversed an overdose, or we had other sort of information in both our public safety and public health databases that really identified a population of people at very high risk of fatally overdosing. And when we asked the question, you know, what's being done to proactively provide these residents of our community services, the answer was nothing. We were basically sitting around and waiting for the 911 line to ring and responding out to subsequent overdoses. So we turned that on its head. We hired clinicians embedded into the police department with specialty training in substance use disorder and skills at breaking down barriers to evidence-based treatment. And we went to work proactively, knocking on doors and building those relationships with people in the grips of addiction, so that when they had that moment of clarity and decided that they wanted to reach out and access services, we made it barrier-free to do so. And we had built relationships with each of these individuals in advance, trusting relationships, so that folks felt comfortably, felt comfortable accessing their local law enforcement agency for help guiding and navigating the complex treatment system that we have here in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. Extremely rewarding work to have people, you know, I had a mom call me. It was late on a Friday, and her son was using and at high risk of fatally overdosing. And just the notion that she called her police chief for help under those circumstances, where the traditional model of policing would have been to send a patrol car out and arrest that young man, we went to work with our clinicians and our treatment provider partners, and quickly were able to get this young man in the healthcare setting that was appropriate for him. And that was a sea change from the early 80s when I first signed up to be a police officer.
Mm-hmm. What would you say the community response and the response within your institution was when you guys decided to shift your policy towards this proactive change?
Yeah. A good question. You know, internally, we had to do a lot of training and manage culture change, which is not easy work. And, you know, many of these law enforcement officers doing their job daily and acting in incredibly difficult circumstances around overdose and addiction in the community, you know, many of them had developed fatigue to responding to the same home, to the same person, and reversing overdoses. But what we learned over time in our training environment was that there was a real lack of knowledge around the science of addiction and the fact that relapse is a part of recovery, and that the importance of building trusting relationships with people who are in the grip hold of addiction has incredible value at the back end when folks want and need services. And so that training and that culture change took time. And, you know, we sort of apply the lessons learned of many decades ago around domestic violence, right? It used to be, you know, when we would respond out and find a woman in an abusive relationship, we would put all the weight and blame where? On the shoulders of the victim, the woman. Why aren't you leaving this batterer? Why don't you pack your bags and leave? You know, how could you live with this terrible person? And all the blame and weight went onto the woman's shoulders, the victim's shoulders, mostly women. And what we learned was that our approach and our policies and our training around domestic violence was completely wrong. Mm-hmm. And that we needed to shift our focus on the batterer and validate victims of domestic violence and the fact that there are many valid reasons why women aren't ready to leave abusive relationships, not the least of which is hope. You know, no woman walks down the aisle hoping that she'll become the victim of domestic violence. You know, women hope and pray that their relationships will get better. And that's human nature, right? And so we learned a lot of lessons around domestic violence and the flawed policies that law enforcement had been employing. And we turned and applied those to addiction. You know, we used to blame and dehumanize folks in the grips of opioid addiction and call them junkies and losers and felons and all this dehumanizing language and approach. And so we trained our police officers to understand, you know, this is very akin to, women who find themselves in abusive relationships. They didn't choose to be there. There are many reasons why they're not ready to leave. We need to validate and support them. There are many reasons why people that are in the grips of addiction aren't ready to get into detox and long-term recovery. So we need to validate that and develop a survival plan, no differently than we did with women in abusive relationships. Mm-hmm. Sit down and as crazy as it might sound, we sat with our clinicians and some of our police officers with people who were using and developed what we call the survival plan, you know, and trained them around the skills necessary to survive their next overdose. Because if they succumb to a subsequent overdose, so, you know, obviously if they're dead, they'll never get into recovery. So we sort of had a two-pronged approach, developed that survival plan. And in doing so, we built trusting relationships with the individual themselves, but also their caregivers. You know, oftentimes as family or others, roommates, you know, partners, what have you. And so we would educate caregivers, educate the user, create the survival plan. And in the process of doing this, we're building trust. Mm-hmm. So that when that person has that moment and they decide that they want to access evidence-based treatment, the planning is already done. Mm-hmm. You know, we in the second prong is sort of, you know, getting caregivers to treat like no differently than a loved one expecting a child. You know, we would have a plan. We would know who the doctor is going to be. We would know what treatment provider we're going to, what the health insurance ramifications are, a bag pack, cigars, balloons, everything we would do for an expecting mom, we need to do for somebody in the grips of addiction so that when they are ready to make that move, the planning doesn't begin then. Because if you start planning at that moment, you've missed your opportunity. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of the work that was done. So that's all the internal stuff. Externally, you know, there was not a lot of pushback, you know, although some, you know, did question, you know, why is law enforcement doing public health work? And it's a valid question. And the answer is because the treatment system had been failing people with the disease of addiction for many decades, and somebody had to step up and call out the flawed system and exercise some leadership and drive policy change. And that somebody became police chiefs in many jurisdictions, particularly those who are affiliated with the Police Assisted Addiction Recovery Initiative. Mm-hmm. And so there were those questions, and there was also questions around, you know, why aren't you arresting these people? They're breaking the law. And we were able to overcome that pushback. And ultimately, in Arlington and beyond, you know, PARI has 500 and counting law enforcement agencies nationwide that are engaging in pre-arrest diversion strategies to get people into medically managed detox. But then more importantly, transitioning out into an environment where the community as a whole not only accepts people in recovery and working at long-term recovery, but embraces those people. And in doing that type of work, we build trust. And ultimately, the police department in Arlington and beyond, was seen as a public service agency that could be trusted and that would be driven by its value system rather than a flawed system of justice or healthcare. Mm-hmm. Emergency departments at hospitals. I mean, who would have thought that, you know, a police chief would be meeting with the director, a medical director for emergency departments around how we're going to manage patients coming in who have experienced a non-fatal overdose. Mm-hmm. But that's what happened. You know, we had a case. We had a case in Arlington that really was the aha moment for us. A young lady, a beautiful young lady, overdosed. We responded out, reversed that overdose, brought her to a Boston area hospital, brought her there for treatment. 7 days later, the same young lady overdosed. We responded out. We reversed the overdose a second time. And brought her to that same Boston area hospital. Now, this was before our program. This is sort of one of the cases that really enlightened us. So after that second fatal overdose, 7 hours later, we responded out to her home, and she had died from an overdose. And we felt a terrible sense of failure at that time. Mm-hmm. And we went back and reconstructed that case. You know, how did this happen, right? And what we learned was that the emergency department that we were bringing her to neither had the desire or the capacity to treat overdose patients. They simply wanted to stabilize them and release them and document it as a, you know, release against medical advice. AMA, that's what they call it. And out the door they go. So our treatment system was taking people who had just had an overdose reversed with nasal naloxone, a brief period of treatment in an emergency department, and then returning them right to the street. Talk about a flawed system. That's a situation where somebody is going to go into immediate withdrawals in a non-medical environment, and what is a sick person going to do under those circumstances? What any sick person would do, get whatever substance it is that makes them feel not sick. And in this case, that's opioids. And so the very system and environment that we created was contributing to, in many cases, and I would argue in lots of cases, causing fatal overdoses. Mm-hmm. So that's where, you know, cases like that caused us to say, we are going to stop. And, you know, we demanded meetings with emergency departments and started to raise Cain about the way folks we were bringing in were being treated and ultimately change in policy. And then Governor Baker and Secretary Sutter's here in Massachusetts, who both have been extraordinary leaders around the opioid epidemic, got legislation passed. And now we have to have trained substance use clinicians in the emergency department and available to such patients. So there's been a lot of great change, mm-hmm. not all of which has been led by law enforcement, but a large part was led by law enforcement. Very, very proud of my colleague police chiefs here in Massachusetts and around the country that have really exercised leadership on this issue.
Mm-hmm. No, you should take great pride in the initiatives that you guys have started, especially PARI, due to its success now. Our research group would like to see initiatives like this nationwide. How would you like to see this implemented?
Yeah, so the reality is that in most jurisdictions, these programs are not driven by political pressure or community pressure. I would say that the majority, overwhelming majority, of these programs are driven by the value systems of the law enforcement agencies that decide to implement these programs. In other words, you know, when I was police chief in Arlington, if I had one pedestrian per month getting run over on Massachusetts Avenue and killed, I would have political pressure, community pressure, and advocacy, you know, pressure to implement safety measures, right? Stop the pedestrians from getting run over and killed. We didn't have that pressure with opioid overdoses. People didn't want to talk about it. They just wanted to ignore it and wish that it wasn't happening. And there was really no pressure on the police department to do anything. We could have remained in our reactive mode and gone on with life. But we recognized our failures. And, you know, everybody likes to throw around the notion of transparency. But being a truly transparent law enforcement agency results in self-correcting behavior, right? Mm-hmm. So if you expose your flaws, it causes you to correct those flaws, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things we started talking about in the community was our failure to drive down the overdose rate and the community's failure. And then that resulted in energy around, okay, we recognize that we can do better. How then do we do better and fix these flawed systems? So it requires a bit of leadership from the law enforcement agency and a little bit of risk taking, right? Let's face it, in America, public officials don't get rewarded for, you know, standing out in front of City Hall saying, hey, you know, we have these major flaws. You know, the system does not support that type of transparency, mm-hmm. but that's what it takes. It takes somebody bringing a sense of urgency to this issue. And, you know, I was honored to have been invited to the White House when the president finally declared the opioid epidemic a public health emergency, which took some pressure. Mm-hmm. I was able to stand with the president when he made that declaration because it is a public health emergency and it requires urgency and resources and leadership and risk-taking. You know, creating that environment in a community where people coming out of detox and recovery treatment centers are embraced by the community no differently than somebody coming back from their cancer treatment or their kidney treatment or other chronic illness type treatment. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have worked hard to do throughout America through PARI, and providing technical assistance to agencies and subject matter expertise and model policy and in many cases small grants or resources to kickstart these programs. Mm-hmm.
I think you make a great point in comparing the treatment of opioid use disorder to other chronic diseases, in that it's multimodal. It requires, you know, efforts from social workers. It requires medication. It requires resources. It's so much more than just, you know, saying go home. You've been helped. So I really like that comparison.
Yeah, and you know, and relevant to, you know, your training, you know, one of the issues that I worked on toward the end of my law enforcement career and now with Alcrim Asian Community Relations is, you know, what's the scope of practice for pharmacists here in the Commonwealth as compared to around the country? And is there opportunity to break down barriers to access for all three FDA medications for opioid use disorder? And, you know, is there sort of some policy advancement that might be advantageous to patients, right? It's all about the patient and creating systems of care where patients can access the treatment of their choice barrier-free. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's some of the stuff that I work on now.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of policy changes, we saw that you traveled to Arizona in 2016 to attend the signing of an executive order. Could you talk about that initiative?
Yeah, so Governor Ducey and his, I believe it was the Secretary of Health, although they call it, but essentially his Secretary of Health invited me out when they rolled out their programming in the Phoenix PD, affiliated with PARI at that time, and they asked me to basically address the audience after the governor around the issues that we're talking about here today, and the need for policy change and culture change in order to make progress at truly addressing the opioid epidemic. Because, you know, harm reduction strategies are absolutely essential. You know, I sat on Governor Baker's Harm Reduction Commission, and some of the work of our harm reductionists has simply been extraordinary at keeping people alive. You know, but I often ask, but what follows? What's next? You know, we don't only want people to survive; we want them to thrive in life, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's the kind of work that Arizona was looking at in terms of creating that culture where long-term recovery in a treatment pathway chosen by the patient, not by systems of care, would be embraced not only in Arizona, not only in Phoenix, but statewide. Mm-hmm. So they've done some extraordinary work, and we are still in contact with the Phoenix PD and Commander Conley out there, who leads their efforts around the opioid epidemic.
That's incredible. It sounds like a really valuable collaboration you guys have established.
Yeah, it was a little funny side note. In the Boston region, we wear these, our Class A uniforms are double-breasted wool Class A uniforms. Mm-hmm. You know, those choker double-breasted, you know, they're very classy looking, very traditional looking. Mm-hmm. So here I am, this guy from Boston in a double-breasted wool overcoat, standing outside of the Arizona State House in, you know, a 90 degree and humid weather. Mm-hmm. The crowd had a lot of fun at my expense, shall we say.
I bet that was a little uncomfortable.
It was.
Speaking of your work in Arizona, what other policy changes would you appreciate seeing in the future?
Oh boy, that's a loaded question. I mean, you know, we talked a little bit about scope of practice for pharmacists, and I think we have a workforce of pharmacists across the nation with advanced level training all of whom could be employed to create access to medications for opioid use disorder. There are three FDA-approved meds, and breaking down access to each of those meds is important. Mm-hmm. But also, embracing patient-centered care. You know, one of the frustrations that I've seen is policymakers trying to determine somebody's recovery journey. You know, it shouldn't be up to, you know, me as a law enforcement official or you as a pharmacist to decide which lever or which door I choose to go through to achieve my recovery. It should be, you know, a system that supports all pathways to recovery. And that's, PARI has been very, very vocal about, supporting all pathways to recovery. So, you know, there's some policy change there. And then parity, parity between behavioral health and addiction medicine and traditional medical surgical medicine. If you break your arm, you have no trouble getting any treatment. Mm-hmm. If you suffer with anxiety, try to find a therapist that takes your health insurance and has capacity to treat you within, 30 days. Very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lack of parity in our treatment system. Here in Massachusetts, Senator Cindy Friedman, who heads up the Mass Senate's Healthcare Finance Committee, has done extraordinary work around this very issue. She's filed legislation in Mass, she has been a real leader on issues around access to healthcare for serious mental illness and addiction. And we need more leadership like that to break down all these barriers. Mm-hmm. There's just simply a lack of equity on the two sides of the treatment system.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And then stigma, right? You know, people like to talk about stigma associated with addiction and serious mental illness. And it's alive and well. We all see it daily. But for me, stigma has a consequence. And stigma results in disparate treatment systems and discrimination. Mm-hmm. I would argue that we elect by choice to have two classes of treatment systems. Medical surgical being class A, behavioral health and addiction being class B. Mm-hmm. And we need to change that. And stigma drives a lot of those policy flaws, and we need to let science drive policy, not emotion.
Absolutely. Stigma is one of the things that we are working on in the Opioid Epidemic Network, specifically just it being such a huge barrier to people wanting to access recovery services. Speaking of that stigma, what major shifts or trends related to stigma have you observed since the approval of more therapies for substance use disorder?
So, again, we're blessed to be in Massachusetts. Governor Baker funded a campaign. You may have seen some of the billboards and ads around State Without a Stigma. Mm-hmm. And he certainly has, as I said earlier, been an extraordinary leader in this issue. And I think we need more leadership like that of Governor Baker's across the country, so that this isn't sort of a fragmented state-by-state approach, so that we bring that sense of urgency that I spoke of earlier around challenging that stigma. And addressing policies that have been driven by the underlying stigma associated with serious mental illness and addiction. It's like unconscious bias. there are people that will tell you, I wouldn't, treat others differently due to their race or ethnicity. But, that on its face is an ignorant statement because of people don't understand their unconscious bias. Mm-hmm. And that applies to stigma as well. A lot of folks that I've engaged with will say, I would never, think unfavorably about somebody who's addicted to opioids. You may be telling yourself that, but your behaviors speak differently. And the unconscious reaction to engaging that population is the area where I think we need to focus, right? It's easy to say, don't have stigma against somebody with a serious mental illness or addiction. That doesn't achieve the desired outcome. It's really getting people to think deeply about these diseases and the fact that they're not moral failings, and the science of the brain is incredibly complex, and the lessons that have been learned through our research, through institutions like yours and others, that would tell us that these are diseases of the brain that need to be treated as chronic illnesses and not moral failings. Mm-hmm. My role is to break down barriers to access to all medications for opioid use disorder around policy issues and community issues, and not advance any one treatment option over the other. Because as I said before, I don't think the system should be driving that. The patients should be making these decisions. Mm-hmm. But I'm not authorized to speak on the record specifically about Vivitrol.
Okay, absolutely.
Now. You guys can comment about it in your podcast about, it's FDA approved for, relapse prevention and alcohol use disorder, but I'm not authorized.
Sure. Well, we're happy to see someone working with companies like this to sort of take a patient-centered approach and really focus on decreasing the stigma.
Yeah, one thing I can talk about is my team at Alkermes, and I think it speaks, and this can be on the record now, I'm back on the record. It speaks well of Alkermes as a company. The team that I work on, the community relations team, is a national team made up of all people who have real lived experiences with addiction, some of whom identify as being in long-term recovery. Some have run recovery treatment centers. One particular individual has run advocacy organizations around campus addiction treatment programs and collegiate recovery programs. So we have this team of, and I with my law enforcement experience, and so we have this team of people who have real lived experiences, not just academic experiences. And our experiences, with serious mental illness and addiction bring value, I think, to the company. I think it speaks well of the company that they would stand up such a dynamic team with this vast experience, and I'm honored to be a member of the team. It's some incredible individuals, mm-hmm. professionals. And then, you did mention alcohol use disorder, and one of the sort of frustrations that I have is that, folks speak of the opioid epidemic as occurring in three waves. Mm-hmm. What everybody seems to forget is that there's one wave that transcended all of the opioid waves, and that's alcohol use disorder. Mm-hmm. We mustn't forget that most of the population that we're servicing with opioid use disorder, were poly substance users, many of whom also abuse alcohol. You know, there were, you know, I read some of the materials this month around Alcohol Awareness Month that approximately 14.5 million Americans live with an alcohol use disorder. I mean, that's huge. Mm-hmm. And the economic impact in the many billions of dollars caring for patients with alcohol use disorder. And so while we are in the midst of the opioid epidemic, we mustn't forget alcohol. And the other thing we're seeing across the country also is a surge in stimulants, including methamphetamine and cocaine. Mm-hmm. So we really have, you know, the past couple of years, life expectancy in the U.S. has gone down, largely due to serious mental illness and addiction. Mm-hmm. We have a country in despair, and it requires major, major investment of resources and sense of urgency from the highest level of government.
No, I absolutely
agree. And others.
Well, I would just like to commend your work and your ethics. You know, advocates like you and like your incredible team, they're so needed and make such an incredible difference in the world, and especially in our country. So thank you for your continued efforts. It's so moving and so impressive.
Oh, thank you. That's very nice. As I said, my last few years as police chief, I became almost solely focused on serious mental illness and addiction. That I was sort of, I realized it was my calling and I needed to move on. Mm-hmm. And I'm blessed to have joined the team at Alkermes and continue the difficult work. But, you know, it's all about the patients.
Absolutely. Well, Mr. Ryan, that's all the questions I have. Is there anything else in particular you would like to discuss?
No, I think we captured it. That little piece about discussing Vivitrol, I hope you'll edit out.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Will do. All right, Mr. Ryan, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. We really appreciate this opportunity.
Thank you, guys, and good luck with your studies. You're doing a lot remotely now, I'm sure.
Yes, we are. Yeah. All online.
My oldest is a freshman at UNH. Mm-hmm. And she had been having a wonderful experience, and unfortunately it was cut short by this COVID situation. But be that as it may, she got 3 more years or 4 more years, whatever she does.
Yeah. Carly and I have both lost our last, this was my senior year and this was Carly's last semester before her rotation. So
we're
all feeling a little bit like we missed out, but it's for the best.
Yeah. Well, good luck to both of you. I wish you well, and don't hesitate to reach out if I can ever help either of you.
Thank you so much.
I also wanted to ask is there a picture online that you don't mind us taking, or could we grab a photo from you for when we do post the podcast?
Yeah, if you look at pariusa.org.
Okay.
pariusa.org.
Sure.
You'll see a picture of me and Jerome Adams.
Okay. Awesome.
Jerome has become a good friend during this work, and he's an amazing guy with an amazing story. His brother is in jail.
Oh, really?
And suffers with opioid use disorder. So, Jerome is just a wonderful, wonderful man.
I can only imagine even just talking with him, the connections you've built.
Oh, he's awesome. He's just a nice, nice person who's in his work for the right reason. And so there's a picture of he and I on that website that I'm sure you could grab.